we have to assume that they had bechira, otherwise they could not have been given a commandment, otherwise they wouldn't have been punished and held responsible. So we see that God immediately institutes punishment. Second suggestion, the first thing that they realized was Ra was the nakedness. I don't know that that's really the case. I may be wrong, but it seems to be a very instinctive reaction. It's automatic. It's just an automatic thing. It doesn't seem like they regarded it as the... I mean, after the fact, perhaps. After the fact, they may have thought. In other words, what motivated them to cover themselves was not a consideration that this is bad, but rather it was just an emotion. It seems like an emotion comes into the picture. Which is not the same thing. Knowledge of good and evil is not the same thing as an emotion. Right? And here we have an emotion. Shame. Right there, in other words, if they had the fear beforehand, doesn't that, and they had a command, doesn't it imply that they had to know good and evil? How could they not? Didn't they know that it was, in other words, you're telling me that they had no concept of good and evil, so why should they follow the command of God? Isn't that the good thing to do? Right? And wouldn't bad be the, didn't they know? As we saw, Chava was talking to the snake, and the snake he said is the Yetzer Hara. And so you see that there's a certain amount of resistance. So her, you know, we're not supposed to do this. It's wrong. She's fighting him. We're not even allowed to touch it. All right, so she added to the, whatever the case, there was a distortion. But she had to have a recognition that that was bad. If they didn't have that recognition of good and bad, so how could you, again, the question would go back to Bechira, he'd be right. In other words, the recognition that there's a good and a bad, isn't that an essential component of Bechira? Because how can you have Bechira if you don't know that there's a good and a bad? That's what we're choosing between, the good and the bad. The Bechata Bechayim, etc., he says, choose the good. Right? So we're really strengthening the question. Your objective is to do the everybody. Everybody has that component within him. He wants to do that which is good, even in Russia, except in his own distorted framework where, what he's doing, his instincts determine what the good is. He believes that that's the good. But it's hard to escape that. He was presupposing that he did not have knowledge of good and evil. Okay? And that's the basis. Although this question then about this faith, again, why is this faith different? Faith, you're correct about faith, that the real evil in faith is that it distorts your relationship with God, but there's a tshuva. So why could he not, once the sin of those tshuva is reinstated, in fact he's on a higher level, a higher plane apparently, right? So we learn about tshuva that when a person returns to God, it's an improved relationship, so to speak. So what you're saying is very good, but you'd have to demonstrate that there's something unique over here that's different. Again, pointing up to the, it seems that there was no part, why, that's a good question also, why couldn't he do tshuva? Since tshuva is a fundamental of the Torah, right? And nothing stands in the way of tshuva, the Rambam says, nothing stands in the way of tshuva. If a person was the worst sinner of all the days of his life, and the worst sin, and he does tshuva on his deathbed, so then he's accepted. And yet, here we're talking about the very first sin, and there's no talk about tshuva. It doesn't seem that way, unless you want to just want to say that Adam didn't do tshuva, unless you want to take it that way. Did he have the opportunity to do tshuva, or did he? Or wasn't he ashamed? Didn't the shame come in before God called out? Moshe wants to say that the Yodei Tov Hara means that it's a different type of knowledge. It's one thing to know it in the abstract. It's another thing to experience it for yourself. It's like
you know something, yeah, first, and then you have to get
through it. Yeah, right. You learn, right. You learn about certain diseases, and you understand them and so forth, but you've never experienced it. There is some of it, and you're sympathetic to people that have it, but then you yourself get it, and then you know it in a different kind of a way. That's Moshe's suggestion. Is that what you're trying to say? So before, you didn't really know it, and that immediate, concrete kind of a way. Okay, that's what Moshe's saying, but we have to analyze whether it's true or not. Also, what's the meaning of that tree? The tree of the knowledge is true. I'm raising a question. Why, of all things that we associate with commands and what's important in human existence, this seems also that the first mitzvah, he was only had one mitzvah apparently, was a Bein Adam Marmotam, which doesn't seem to be, seems more like a chok, if anything, right? Just, there was no command not to harm, not to destroy, and so forth, you know, ethical, moral. It's a good point. But that doesn't go to what the Moshe is saying. The question I would ask Moshe is that perhaps this would explain the Yodei Ra. But what about Yodei Tov? Tov, he knew.
Right.
No, so then, no, but the, what we're saying is as a result of eating from the fruit of the tree, you will come into the knowledge of good and evil. But good, he knows already in the practice. And you're saying that the knowledge we're talking about is the additional insight that comes from the practical, from the action, right? But that would only apply to Ra. Tov already, he was engaged in. Tov, he knew in that concrete way. It wouldn't explain Tov. So far, it seems to be pushing. In other words, I don't think that goes far enough. It seems like the Yisan Kelo Kim, Yodei Tov Ra, it's not, you know, to the point that you're making that you'll have a greater insight into what it's like through the experience, the experiential factor. What you're saying is true, but it seems that it's from the system that it's much more than that. It's like you're being gaining entrees, because that's why the Yisan Kelo Kim comes into the picture. It's like what indicates the new kind of knowledge which you don't have access to right now. And of course, you do have knowledge of that, right? Yeah, but you don't have it on the experiential. It's just a dimensional thing. So my question against you would be on two bases. A, the experiential factor would apply only to the Ra, the goodies are experiencing. Because as long as you're obeying God, he has experiential knowledge of the good. But B, it seems that the Eastern Kale of Kim, Ladas Tov Ra, would seem to be more than just a new dimension of something which you already partake of now. It means you're going to have a whole new area. You'll be introduced to a whole new area. It doesn't seem to go far enough. Well, no, raising. In other words, is this the only possible thing that he could have done which would have constituted a sin?
Kind of have all
that. Kind of have all that. Yeah, murder. So could he not have murdered his wife and in a fit of anger? That's also interesting. One thing that's also very interesting. How do we tie this in with the concept of the Shevah Mitzvah? All right, six, right? Because Avraham Menachai comes later. Not even the limb of it. He wasn't permitted to eat animals at all. So he had six and then seven Melachad Lord. And 1 second, when did he receive them? After he was driven out of Gan Eden or in Gan Eden? So then, why is this focus? Why is the highlight on this particular Mitzvah? And what about the other commands? Now, if he had other commands, right? So then clearly he knew that what was right and there was a right and a wrong for him too, like for everybody else. That's a good point. I never thought of connecting it over there. This heightens the question, theory. To say that man needed commands, I understand, because that's part of the definition of Adam, the being who must exercise the chira and must be in control of his instinctual elements. So that's why, without a command, the command, living, under a command of God, defines him as man. That's the essence of his relationship with God. He follows the commands of God. So I understand why there must be a command. But why must there be this particular command when he already has the commands, which are the body of the seven Melachad Lords? Obviously, whether they had a mitzvah or a vote. It doesn't seem that there's not one of the seven Melachad Lords, right? Although God did say, it was a blessing. It was a blessing. So we have to understand what is a bracha. It's the idea of a blessing if it's not a command. Question, so if I was making the point as to whether the nullified laws could have existed in that time, that's an important question. And Max says that the Gemara learns that from Vayitzav, Allah Adam. In other words, that from the truth and not pretend. But we have to look it up. Two major problems pertaining to the Chet.
is the first of all, it seems as though he did not have knowledge of good and evil prior to the break. And this would seem to be impossible with the idea that he had reason, he had knowledge, and he had commandment. Therefore he had to have bechira. And he was held accountable, which meant that he knew that it was wrong to violate the command. So that's something he has to know. Also, the immediate effect of the fate is to cause him to have a feeling of shame at the fact that he was naked, and that is not so immediately understandable. That's something that requires an explanation. Okay? He says, now mark our reply, which was as follows. Quote, you appear to have studied the matter superficially, and nevertheless you imagine that you can understand the book, which has been the guide of past and present generations, when you for a moment withdraw from your lust and appetite and glance over its contents as if you were reading a historical work or some poetical composition. Let's just pause and, you know, consider that for a moment. Because the Rambam didn't just write things without thinking about them. Many people have asked the question, that at first he refers to him as a learned individual. A learned man, and he phrases the question. Now he's talking to him as though he's a fool. What's the nature of this critique? What does that mean? And the Rambam is the kind of person that dealt with the issues. What does this have to do with anything? Why is he suddenly attacking the individual? The Rambam held that the question, the person had intelligence, he's an intelligent individual, but he criticized him for making a basic mistake in his attitude towards the Torah. The Torah is a book of, which of course it comes from God, so it's a book of infinite wisdom. And even though it's written on many levels, a person shouldn't, that's already a sign of a certain haughtiness in a person, that he imagines that this is it, that he understands the book just by reading it like any other book. He's treating it like any other book. That's why he's criticizing him. You're wrong about that. We don't know the nature of this person and his level of belief. But then he wouldn't have asked the question. I mean, if he held that the book was of no consequence, was a nonsensical work, so then why even bother addressing the Rambam with the question? What's the point? Then it's pointless. Unless he just wants to attack. So therefore, if he did state the question, he must have held that the book is significant. There's significance here. If that's the case, then he's to be blamed for his manner in which he treats it. Without any greater depth. That's the point. That's exactly the point. And that is why he deserves to be criticized, because that the way in which he treated it was not in line with the way he expected him to regard it. There are many people like that. If the person was an absolute kofar who had no respect to Torah, so then I would understand. In other words, he's faulted for the way he treats the book, but if that was his attitude to begin with, then the Rambam wouldn't even talk to him. He's like, it's a waste of time. You only deal with a person that espouses a certain respect for the book on some level. He has to regard it as being significant. Then you could say the way you're reading the book is not in line with the attitude that you have. That's where he's a fool, the way he treats the book. Okay. Collect your thoughts and examine the matter carefully, for it is not to be understood as you at first sight think, but as you will find after due deliberation. Namely, the intellect which was granted to man as the highest endowment was bestowed on him before his disobedience. That's the first mistake that he made, and we noted that yesterday. That's because he's associating, the question was associating intellect with the knowledge of good and evil. And the Rambam is saying that no, he had intellect before he obtained knowledge of good and evil. Alright? And the proofs are, with reference to this, the Bible states that man was created in the form and likeness of God. That's one of the proofs that we mentioned. On account of this gift of intellect, man was addressed by God and received his commandments. Yesterday, when I was going over it, with regard to our ongoing question as to whether he was already, he had received the Noahide laws, the language of this translation is he had received commandments. So he's not referring only to the command not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but commandments, which could only mean the Noahide laws. Okay, said, and the Lord God commanded Adam. For no commandments are given to the brute creation, or to those who are devoid of understanding. I mentioned other proofs. I don't have to mention everything, but there are clearly other proofs that he possessed intellect. In Hebrew, it says Vetziva or so. So it's not definitive at this point. That is the fact that he was engaged in the naming of the animals. He brought all the animals to name them, which we said really meant to define them. Naming is defining. Okay. Through the intellect, man distinguishes between the true and the false. This faculty Adam possessed perfectly and completely. The right and the wrong are terms employed in the science of apparent truth, morals, not in that of necessary truth. Truth and necessary truth. As, for example, it is not correct to say, in reference to the proposition, the heavens are spherical, it is good, or to declare the assertion that the earth is flat to be bad. But we say of the one it is true, of the other it is false. Similarly, our language expresses the idea of true and false by the terms MS and Sheker, of the morally right and the morally wrong, by Tov and Ra. So our language distinguishes between two different ideas. One idea is true, false, MS, Sheker. The other one is Tov, something which is good, and Ra. Okay. So, at least on a tentative basis, how would you explain the difference between the two? Just an explanation. True and false would mean whether something is true means that it corresponds to reality. That's the way it is. You're describing something in reality. So, if we say the heaven is spherical, whatever. So, if that statement corresponds to reality, it's true. If it doesn't, then it's false. That's simple enough. It's relative to something. Good and bad has to be relative to something. That's why it's not like absolute. It's not apparent. If something can be good for you, it can be bad for somebody else. You know, wings are good for a bird, it's not good for a person, obviously. In other words, the world of, that's why he calls it apparent, the world of good and bad means it presupposes that for something, you know, there's a being in existence, something is in existence, and it has a purpose, right? So something could either be good. Good would be in terms of fulfilling. That's what it means when God said that it was good. It means that it has a certain objective. There's a certain objective. Right, if you don't presuppose that things had an objective, then the entire statement of God said that it was good, what do you mean it was good? What's good about it? What's bad about it? Means that there must have been some purpose that God had in mind, and good meant it was in line with his purpose. So the world of good and bad presupposes a purpose. And now we're talking about whether something is good for it or bad for it. Say, similarly, our language expresses it right. Thus, it is the function of the intellect to discriminate between the true and the false. A distinction which is applicable to all objects of intellectual perception. Okay, now listen carefully. When Adam was yet in a state of innocence, now you see, as we go through, note the nuances. There was a change in state then, when he was in a state of innocence, meaning free of the faith, and was guided solely by reflection and reason, on account of which it is said, the Hebrew is Vachasre Ma'at Me Elohim. Here Elohim means angels. Thou hast made him, meaning man, little lower than the angels. That's what the Tehillim refers to man. This is, but the Rambam says it's a reference to man as he was 3, okay, he was not at all able to follow or to understand the principles of apparent truth. But every word here is very important. When Adam was yet in a state of innocence and was guided solely by reflection and reason, that is a very important statement. He was guided solely by reflection and reason. Okay. That has a meaning, but the conclusion, he was not at all able to follow or to understand the principles of apparent truth. The most manifest impropriety, namely, to appear in a state of nudity, was nothing unbecoming according to his idea. He could not comprehend why it should be so. That was a bit difficult. What does one thing have to do with the other? In fact, you mean he couldn't understand? The reason why he did not feel any shame at being naked was because of a lack of understanding? He had a lack of understanding, he couldn't understand that there's something wrong with this, and then he gained a new understanding? That's very difficult. That, I think, more or less seems to be in line with the questioner. That's the questioner thing. So it's a higher level, and it attains a new level of knowledge. Let's continue, though. After man's disobedience, however, when he began to give way to desires which had their source in his imagination and to the gratification of his bodily appetite, as it is said, and the wife saw that the tree was good for food and delightful to the eyes. Now listen to this statement. He was punished by the loss of part of that intellectual faculty which he had previously possessed. What does that mean? He lost part of his intellectual faculty which he had previously possessed. So the Rambam is saying there's a major change going on. But this is difficult. What do you mean? What was the loss? He therefore transgressed a command with which he had been charged on the score of his reason. And having obtained the knowledge of the apparent truth, that's one result. Now he enters into the world. He doesn't explain how that occurs, but now he obtains the knowledge of the apparent truth. He was wholly absorbed in the study of what is proper and what is improper. What do you mean he was wholly absorbed? Because beforehand he was not absorbed. Beforehand he couldn't relate to these fields. And he was wholly absorbed in the study of true and false. Now he was wholly absorbed in the study of what is proper and what is improper. He fully understood the magnitude of the loss he had sustained. So it's not clear what the loss was. What he had forfeited, and in what situation he was thereby placed. According to the Rambam, this is a big loss, forfeiture, and a new situation. Hence we read, and you shall be like Elohim, knowing good and evil, and not knowing or discerning the true and the false. While in necessary truth, we can only apply the words true and false, and not good and evil. Further observe the passage, and the eyes of both were opened, and they knew they were naked. It is not said, and the eyes of both were opened, and they saw. What the man had seen previously, and what he saw after this circumstance, was precisely the same. There had been no blindness which was now removed. But he received a new faculty whereby he found things wrong which previously he had not regarded as wrong. The question is, first of all, it does not seem to answer our basic question to explain why previous to the chayt he did not know the idea of room and good and bad. All he says is that there are two areas of knowledge, the necessary and the apparent, right? Now I can understand that he was totally absorbed in the study of the necessary, but why couldn't he relate to the idea of good and bad? And we said yesterday that would seem to come along with the idea of having a commandment. He had to know that it was good. If he didn't know that it was good to keep the commandment, then bad to observe, bad to violate, then how could he have a commandment? And also, what does it mean that he was punished by the loss? How does that work? It was a loss of the intellectual faculty. And what does it mean that he was wholly absorbed in what is proper? The magnitude of the loss. What's going on over here? And how does it work? And also, the Rambam says that the reason why he did not, the reason why he wasn't ashamed about being naked was because that's part of good and bad, and he wasn't involved in that. That's what he says. What about lo tov ve'yosa adam levado? It is not good for the man to be alone. Is that something that he knew or didn't know? Ul adam lamata eza kenegda. That's lo tov. Okay, you have to do. What we have to recognize is that a profound change occurs. This is clear from the Rambam. I'm expressing the story. A profound change occurs as a result of this chait. Of course, that's what makes this chait different than every other chait. Every chait will effectuate a change, but not a qualitative change in the person. So they can, in the construction, the very composition of the person, it will affect the change in his relationship to God and its subject to tshuva. But this is different. Now, what we have to focus on is what was the essential change which occurred as a result of the chait, and which will explain everything that we're talking about. The emergence of shame, the introduction into the world of good and bad, what the Rambam says, the fact that he was wholly absorbed, the loss that the Rambam is talking about. It all relates back to this one basic fundamental change. The fact that he's no longer in a state of innocence. The state, a different type of state, in which the David HaMelech refers to him as being Ma'at Me'elohim, slightly below the angels. That's what we've got to focus in now. What change occurs? And that is the factor which marks this chait as different. And the reason also, this will also explain to you why it's included in the story of creation. It's part of the very process of creation, this chait, and not part of history. Very good point. I just think as you were talking, along the same lines, for example, let's assume, before certain different stages in your development brings, as you all know, brings certain problems with it. For example, let's say before the onset of puberty, you're not interested, you have no interest in sexual things, in girls, things like that. So let's say a kid who's very content to whatever he's doing, to play ball and to study, and he has no conflict whatsoever, he's not at all interested in the opposite sex. And then suddenly, because of his chemical changes or whatever, now all of a sudden he's interested in girls and this, and he's got conflicts, and so you have to have rules and regulations and so on. It's a whole new world of basically a problem. Of course, he doesn't look at it that way, but that's basically what it is. Which he never had before. Now, I know it may sound far-fetched, but I think that that's an analogy which will help us. Take a look at Ki Rashi over here, Ki Chazal. But you'd have to say then that Adam in maturity had the same constitution as a child. So he was, according to contemporary people, he was totally immature. Right? He was completely immature, you'd have to say, because he didn't have the faculty of faith altogether. Let's turn now to a little bit ahead of the story in Peret Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Hei. Vayeda Adam Od Ishto, Vatela Ben, after the incident of Cain and Hevel, right? Both forces were killed by Cain, and Cain was banished. So Adam, Vayeda Adam Od, he knew his wife again, interesting expression, again, and she bore a son, and they called his name Shake. But God has given the other, another child, in the place of Hevel, but Cain had killed him. So we all descend from Shake, though. The term Od is very important. Od means yet more. Right? Hello, Rashi says. Lulameh, Lulmos, teacheth, Shem is so full of taiva al-tavaka.
to quote from Rosh Rabbah, that a title was added to his title. And that is explained more. What does that mean? That is the key to the entire story. Oh, this is so. The relationship between husband and wife changed after the chedesh. A title was added to his title. There was a change in the nature of the sexual title, which came about as a result of the chedesh. Now, what was the character of the chedesh? Explain to you how Chazal explained. And they say that before the they use this terminology, I think this will be easier to understand. They say that before the chedesh, it was Yetzer Hara of the chedesh. The Yetzer Hara was external. After the chedesh, the Yetzer Hara was in the shnim. The Yetzer Hara was internalized. Kibbutz inclination was external, now it became internal. This is, by the way, the essence of the change that he went through from the state of innocence. When he was in a state of innocence, the Yetzer Hara was external. When he was no longer in a state of innocence, and in that state, he was totally absorbed in truth and pleasure. And there was no such thing as shame. He could go around naked. There was no sexual shame. Afterwards, however, when the HR became internalized, and that exactly was what the... You do see the implication being, we don't know exactly what the attraction is, but it does seem as Tyler. She saw that the fruit was Sa'avihila'inoyim, it was desirous to the eyes. It had something to do with man's sexual lust. Something to do. It had an effect upon him. That's the arena, the Rambam says, in the arena of the imagination. So he had the choice. This was a very big choice. It wasn't just a question of obedience or disobedience. It wasn't just another, each ministry and only ministry, but it was basically God was presenting him with two different modes of existence. Okay, but we're going a little ahead of ourselves. Let's just stick to the one point. Yetzer of the Chutz, Yetzer of the Shnim. And I think that that will explain everything. But then Yetzer of the Shnim, Yetzer of the Chutz exists today also. Everybody has Yetzer Hara, and you, within your own psyche, you can make a distinction between Yetzer Hara of the Shnim and Yetzer of the Chutz in your own life. You follow?
Sexual connection, but the
connection's natural branding. For him, Yetzer and Bechutz means that it's not an internal necessity. Your psyche is not fixated. There's no fixation. However, if the phenomenon is in front of you, you can depend to certain foods. You can have it with anything. There are certain foods that you just won't eat under any circumstances. Okay? Then there are certain foods that are, you know, like coffee. You have to have your coffee every day. That's the eighth element of men. That's you're attached to it. You look forward to it. You're a person, let's say cigars for some people, or cigarettes, the same thing. For some people, it's in the within. It's internalized. They have a fixation. They need to. They don't have it. They're going to be upset. Their psyche is looking for it. Then there are those people that it's the b'chut, which means to say, under the right circumstances, they don't smoke, they don't afford an issue, but if you present them with a nice cigar, they'll enjoy it. They can partake of it. Okay? That's the b'chut. But when it's not there, and then they go back, they don't think about it, and they're not interested in it. That's the b'chut. Okay? That's external. It means you, in order for you to partake of it, you need an external stimulus. And mitzvah is not an external stimulus, but it's an inherent, integral necessity that you have and you look forward to. It's like when you fall in love with someone, it's now become internal. Or you could have a friend, for example, that's the b'chut. When you travel to Europe and you stop by and you see and you enjoy the evening and you go out together, you have a good time. Then when you leave, you don't miss it necessarily. Then there are certain people that are your friends. You got to talk to them. Sometimes a week, if you don't talk to them, you're missing something. They become internal, part of your life. Okay, now I'm to say, the Yetzer Hara, which here we're talking about Tava, we mean the sexual instinct was entirely external. That is, when he saw Tava, then he would be attracted. He needed the external stimulus. But when he did not see her, there was no internal necessity, no attachment to the sexual per se. What does this mean? So where was the energy attached? What was his nature, the state of innocence that he was in pre-the-faith?
Well,
he is Israel.
He was created for a purpose. That's the whole idea of the Gan Eden.
God has created the essence of man. The entire nature of man was, he was an instinctual being who was ma'at, the polluted law of the angel. He possessed a divine soul and intellect, and he had each being that God created had a purpose. And each being was created, was designed to be in line with its purpose. What was the purpose of man? Well, it's, no, the purpose is not true. The purpose was to be, we see its purpose. Naming means to study the creation, and thereby through the appreciation of the wisdom of God. That was his Torah. His Torah was the creation. To study the creation and to enjoy the Chachmas Hashem and to be able to have a relationship with the Creator through the knowledge. And his nature was in line with his purpose. His energy essentially was that was his energy. His internal attachment, his instinctual attachment was to the love of Chachmas. However, he did have the capacity for the Yetzirah. And that, however, was the choice. And that was the choice that he was given. He could remain in that state. That's why the Rambam says, by the way, that he was wholly absorbed. It's like you said, like the case you gave before, like a kid. He's not involved in the world of dating, not dating girls, and stuff. He's totally absorbed in whatever he's absorbed in. And he felt no shame. Because he had to control, of course he did have instincts, and he had to control them, but he only had two faculties. More than two faculties, instinct and reason. That's what the Rambam says. He lived purely on the basis of reason and reflection. Now how do you explain this? As soon as he sinned, obviously some change took place, but the first effect we see of that change is the emergence of shame. How do you account for shame? Because there was nothing in man that would cause him to feel shame. You have to understand psychology. Where does shame come from? Does it come from the instinct?
No.
It's not part of the instinct. There's no instinct to feel shame. The instinct is just the opposite. The instinct is a desire for certain outlets. Does shame stem from reason? Not at all. There's no rational reason why a person feels shame. It's not a rational phenomenon. Why should a person, if a person thought about it, who says that he was guided solely by reason and reflection, he did not feel any shame. What difference? Why should a person feel ashamed, more shame because of one part of the body or because of another part of the body? It's not a rational thing. If a person was purely rational, he did not feel shame. Part of the creation. So where does shame come from? From a certain faculty that we have, which is called conscience or superego, whatever you want to call it. It's another faculty in man. If you remove, that's why children don't feel shame. Children don't feel shame, and children do feel shame at that point in time before reason has come into the picture. They don't feel shame as real children when they have purely instinctual. And the shame does come about before reason, before they have the capacity for reason. But at a certain point in their development, the conscience, the superego, comes into the picture. That's a new force what you must posit then is that at that point in time, God created a new faculty. Now the Rambam says that. The Rambam says that on page 16. When he's explaining, the eyes of both were open and they saw, he says there had been no blindness which was now removed, but he received a new faculty whereby he found things wrong which previously he had not regarded as wrong. So God now creates a new faculty. We therefore see the blueprint. In terms of God's blueprint for man, this is a very, very important point. The essence of man, as he was intended to be before the take, was to be a being of reason and instinct. Or I guess what Aristotle would call a rational animal. And conscience was not a part of the essence of man. This is very important because most people regard conscience as being let conscience be your guide. Conscience being the distinctive feature of man. According to the story, it is not. And represents part of the downfall of man. But to summarize, the chait brings about a change in the instinctual orientation of man. We have to describe that more fully. Have a clearer picture of what it was like. This, for some reason or other, we don't understand why, necessitates a change in God's blueprint for man, the creation. Now God creates a new faculty. Why is that necessary? Beforehand, that faculty was unnecessary. Had man not sinned, he would never have conscience. So the perfect nature of man without the sin would be a being without conscience. Conscience is not the most noble feature of man at all. The conscience is something which was brought into the picture as a result of man's deviation. That's an interesting idea. That's how the Torah views conscience. Why man is the way he is, and how should we look at certain faculties within us? Okay. Yetzer, true. Nim is not a reference only to the sexual, but the sexual over here is featured because it's the most primary in terms of the instinctual. But you're right; it means all the instincts. I make it clear: God created conscience, a new faculty. That's why the story is included in the story of creation. Man had not yet; the creation wasn't complete, because what we do see from this is that man participated in his own creation. The creation of man is different than the other beings. Man is a participant in his own creation. He is given the power to decide what type of a being he will be. That's what marks this chait as being different than all the other sins. Of course, consisting in the corruption of his reason. So you must ask, what caused that? Well, what caused it was the power of the imagination. He gave in to the picture. It has to be, because he had reason, and reason dictated that he should not do this. And somehow or other, he was able to distort his reason and to convince himself that he should do this. Now, what was that other force? The desires which were rooted in the imagination. That's what you've got to be on guard against. That's a very vital lesson. A person doesn't sin because of a particular object. He only sins because of the imagination. Or Ruch Shtuski, but the imagination. And he's pursuing something not in reality. If a person pursues things in reality, he wouldn't sin. He only sins because he pursues something which is exists only in his imagination. That's why Shlomo calls it Havel Avolim, vanity. It's a vanity. It's something which you create. It's a figment of your imagination. So you fall in love with the fantasy, but you have to live with the reality.
It's Mechathos.
Yesterday we concluded that the reason, the key issue that we were focusing on was the emergence of the emotion of shame. Now, what brought that about? And we said that clearly the only possible explanation would be that there was a new faculty. A new faculty came into being. And that's why the story is included in the creation. The Rambam said the same thing, a new faculty. So it's not a natural result. In other words, it cannot be explained in terms of the manner in which Adam was constituted before the Chay. And that's why the Pasuk says clearly that they were both naked for Lo Yifashashu. It wasn't because they hadn't sinned, as some people have suggested. It was simply because it wasn't in their nature. There was no basis for the feeling at all. We have to explain what necessitated this change. If that was the will of God, and apparently that was that, in order to understand the proper design of man, the way God had intended man to be in the ideal situation, you have to look at man as he was in creation, in Gan Eden, before the Chay. And therefore, we've established that he was a creature who consisted of two components, the Telem Elokim and the instinctual. And there was no basis, therefore, for shame. As a result of the chait, a new faculty comes into being. Now, what's the connection? What is the connection between the... where's the causality, in other words? As a result of the chait, he needs this new faculty. The question is why? Why doesn't he remain as he is? And then, just like after the chait, if a person sins, there's a concept of tshuva. Okay, every sin will affect you in a certain way, but it doesn't affect you in that fundamental way and bring about a fundamental change in your whole makeup, and it doesn't necessitate a new creation. So we have to understand is
the causation, the reason behind it. Why it was, if this is the will of God that man should not have conscience, and we have to explain that, I mean, because we take conscience for granted. Something we never even think about. Why does man have a conscience? Why is it there in the first place? What's the purpose? What's its role? That's an interesting question in its own right. Almost to us, it seems inconceivable that you could have a human being without conscience. When we encounter someone who's extremely brutal, you know, and uncaring, so we say that they're lacking a conscience, therefore they're not even human. We don't regard such a person as being human. Yet you see that we've discovered that the ultimate human is without conscience. Yeah, the Rambam is getting at that, because the Rambam's point is to show, don't think that this is a reward, as the questioner is asked, if the man seems to be elevated, because he's taking this whole arena of good and evil as being something positive. And his whole point is to show that this is a big fall. So again, as Mel says, so conscience appears to be a punishment. He says, of course, you have to explain how it's a punishment, because punishment too is something which has to make sense, the punishment of God. God doesn't punish arbitrarily. Whatever God does, even when God punishes, is with mercy. Interestingly enough, there's a very important point that has to be mentioned over here. Interestingly, this is extremely important. The two accounts of creation, two accounts. In the first account, you only have which name of God is used?
Okay.
The first account is purely Elohim, and in the second account is always Hashem Elohim. What's the reason for that? Anybody familiar? In the first account, it's Midas Hadin. The second account is Hashem Elohim, it's Midas Rachamim. Now, where do you see Midas Rachamim in the second? First of all, what is Midas Rachamim? That's something we have to understand, to whatever extent we can. Because we negate the idea that God has Midas, though that would seem to be contrary to the idea of God's unity. I mean, God doesn't have division. God doesn't act one. Like we have an emotion of compassion. We have a compassionate side, we have an angry side, we have different sides, because we're not unity. We're physical. Okay, so that's the problem in general. But specifically, where do we see Midas Halacha? If anything, the second account does not seem to indicate Midas Halacha. He's being punished in the second account. He's being driven out of Gan Eden, and she's being punished. The woman is being punished. Everybody's getting their just desserts, so to speak. So the problems become even greater as we go along. The problem we have to face is the existence of conscience, whether it's good for man or not. And we're going to find ourselves in this dilemma. If we are going to say that it's a good for man, so why was it not there from the start? Why is it not included in the plan? That would seem to indicate that it is not good. On the other hand, if you're going to say that it's not good for man, then why is it being brought into the picture at this point in time? That's the problem we're going to have. The question is, as Avi points out, that we, Sarah Chazal say that as a result of the chet, there was a fundamental change in the nature of his instinctual makeup. Yetar mebuchutz, now is yetar mebuchnim, internalization of the inclination, of the desire. And then the question is, at this point, was he then still Adam? And I'm going to maintain that at this point in time, he's no longer Adam. And that's the meaning of the idea that on the day that you eat from it, you will die. Because you exist only because of the will of God. Everything that exists, that's the first episode in the Torah, in the Rambam. That if nothing exists, the only being who has true existence is God. Inherent existence. And everything else that exists, exists only because of the will of God. So something exists only because of the will of God, but we know that if that God's will relates to it, that the Torah teaches us, only as long as it is in line with God's will. It has its character. So there is, it's God's will that there should be a being who has the character of Adam. And once he ceases to be Adam, man can exist only when he's made. The only thing, the difference between man and the other beings is that the other beings really have no control. See, by nature, they have the character that they are designed to have. Their purpose has been programmed into their very nature. They don't have any control. But man has because man has the chira, he has the capacity to change his character, to change his definition.
What does that mean? It means that what is Adam? What is Adam? What I'm saying over here is that man, Adam, can be considered as Adam only when he's functioning in a certain manner. As we said, he's a being who's acting in accordance with rationality. He's an instinctual being who functions on the basis of his chachma. That's what the Rambam said. Adam was yet in a state of innocence and was guided solely by reflection and reason. He was guided by reflection and reason, on account of which it is said, thou hast made him little lower than the angels. So when he's functioning, that was his purpose. God designed him in such a way that it's best suited for him to fulfill his purpose, which was what? To be guided by reflection and reason. As long as he's operating in that way, that's Adam, a being who has instincts, but does not live, his way of life is not determined by his instincts. Okay? He, through his seichel, retains control over his instincts. He's the master, exactly. Now, if that is the case, so what is the function of a conscience? Or what does he need a conscience? What is the purpose of a conscience? His energy was completely in line with his purpose. All of his energy was directed towards the attainment of Chachma. And the Yetzer Hara was only the Chutz. In that situation, so the way he was designed, he did not need any other assistance. He didn't need any other force to help him to achieve his objective. His Tzelem Elokim, his Seichel, was sufficient to control the instinctual part of him. Why? Because the instinctual part of him was Nechutz. Internally, all of his energy was directed towards the good, to wisdom. As long as that situation, that's the way he was intended to be by creation. As long as he remained in that situation, there was absolutely no need for a conscience. There was no purpose. That's why the Rambam says he was wholly absorbed. In what? In truth, in objective truth. He wasn't involved in systems of morality, what I should do, what I shouldn't do, where to go the line, where to make boundaries, and so on and so forth. He was full of his energy. He was directed towards the outside, towards the external world, the pursuit of Chachma, which that's what he means, the world of a true and false. The world of good and bad had no reality for it. For what? What are you talking about? Point. Once the Yetzer became internalized, that means, as, see, the state of Yetzer Mephim is the state that we're in now. Yetzer Leva Adam Ram and Ura. It's basically all of the energy of a person is not directed towards, but no one has a desire to obtain Chachma. All the desires are geared towards the fantasies, towards the instinctual. Now, once that was the case, you see, so then he was totally defeated. Then reason was insufficient. Then he would have lost his character of being a Tzelem Elokim. In fact, he would have been dangerous. Then he'd be an animal. All of his inclinations would be too powerful for reason to control. So therefore, he'd be worse than any of the animals. Because we know that man is the most dangerous of animals because he has seichel. Because he has intelligence. See, the other animals are limited. Their instinctual capacity is limited. But man is unlimited because he has the ability to use his mind. But now the mind would be completely in the service of the instinct. And that's basically the essence of a Rasha. All the Rishayim, the dangers of Rishayim are highly intelligent. But what makes them Rishayim is that they're completely, their intelligence is completely controlled by their instincts, and they now use the intelligence to gratify all of their instincts. So now you can totally destroy that. That's not other. That's just an animal, a higher level of animal. That's what it means, on the day that you eat from it, you shall die, meaning you're chayav nisus, because that's not God's will, you have no basis for existence. When Rav Chaim mentioned that case about the creation of a golem, and he says to put it back into the dust, it means that they see, because there's a being that has no tzelem elokim, that has the human form, which means intelligence, an intelligent being without a soul, is it's not God's will that such a being should exist. So therefore, at that point in time, in accordance with Midas HaDin, what does Midas HaDin mean when God is acting in accordance with the absolute, the ultimate ideal of man? He had deviated from the ultimate ideal. That was the highest state to be in, was the state free of sin. So according to Midas HaDin, he should have been destroyed. That's it. Didn't work. He had Bechira. He had Bechira. He was given the choice. He was that's the idea of the Eit Hadas Tov V'ra. He was given the choice to remain in this state that I've placed you in, or to change your state by partaking of the fruit of that tree. I'm saying it's correct. That the immediate result, now we can understand why there was a need for the creation of a new force. And that's where you have the concept of Midas Harachmim. That means to say that when God adjusts, that God adjusts to the changes that occur due to the fact that man deviates. That's what we call it, Rachman. It's an adjustment. In other words, in accordance with strict then he should have been destroyed, because he no longer lived up to the true ideal. But God makes adjustments and enables him to continue to be Adam. Now, in order to be Adam, a counterforce was needed. He had to introduce a new force, because reason itself would not have been enough if it was going up against the Yetzer Hara, which was Mibifnim, which means that as soon as he wakes up in the morning, all of his energy is directed towards Taiva, towards the instinctual. And the instinctual has the power to seduce the reason, to convince reason to find out that it's really a good, and so forth. So now, reason itself would not have been sufficient. A person doesn't naturally, like a person has a day off, even yeshiva, learning, he doesn't naturally want to learn. Until he reaches a very high level, it's not like he doesn't feel that pull. The pull that you feel is usually for an instinctual thing. That's what you learn about the grah says, you know, one of the tests the grah gave, that if you feel a tremendous desire when in the time of the mitzvah, from the stomach comes from the Yetzer Hara, because that's not your natural inclination. However, when you do get involved, the way it works is like this. The attachment to ideas, to knowledge that we have, is not innate within us. We don't have an innate desire, I can't wait to study. You don't feel that emotional pull. However, once you get involved in it, you see, you need it's a ruchot. You need an external stimulus to get you involved. Once you get involved, you've had the experience, you get involved in a sidur, you go to a class, you're shearing, and you're totally absorbed, you enjoy it very much. Then when you leave, you know, slowly but surely, all the energy starts to go to the tithes, to the fantasies. And the same thing happens every day. You wake up in the morning, and the energy by nature is going towards the tithes. See? And in order to get yourself involved in chachma, it requires an extraneous stimulus. I mean, of course, as you develop, you know, you push yourself, and as you obtain a greater love of knowledge, it changes. But the natural course of man, as we know it today, is the Yetzer Hara is the Mifnim. That's innate. Now, that's why the conscience was created. Because I think Moshe is very good. Without conscience, he simply would have been guided by his instincts, and the mind would have been just a slave of the instinctual. So now I needed a counterforce. That's what conscience is. Conscience creates a counterforce. So now he's in a state, the state that we know, the state of conflict. So on the one hand, he has powerful desires, and on the other hand, he has the emotions. You see, the inhibitions that come from conscience, so he's in a state of conflict. And the state of conflict activates the mind. In order to get out of the conflict, he has to use his mind. Without this, man would have... So in other words, this is really compassion. This is Midas HaRachamim, that God is willing to deviate from the ideal and to make the adjustments that have been necessitated due to man's corruption, due to man's misuse of his Bechira. And now he's reinstated as Adam. He has the capacity to be Adam because of this new faculty. Yeah, but this faculty This is a tremendous price to pay. Now he's involved in the world of good and bad. He never had to deal with this before. You see, now that you have all these instinctual drives, you have to have a whole system of morality. Because you can't repress the instinct entirely, then you're going to be in a state of pain, frustration. And you can't get into it completely, then you're an animal. So you're always involved in drawing the line. So you have to work out all systems of morality. When is it good, when is it right, when is it wrong, and so on and so on. It's a whole new world. And there's a tremendous loss of energy. That's everything, that's the big loss. That's what Max was referring to. A tremendous loss. Beforehand, he didn't have to think about these things. All the energy was directed towards knowledge. The instinctual was a minimalistic element in his life. Now, all the energy is drawn in the other area. I mean, it's a tremendous distraction. Tremendous distraction. So therefore, that's why the Rambam says that now he became holy, of course. Now the whole Asik of man, until he can get to that level of being involved in Chachmas, he has to work on his morals and perfecting himself and totally involved in the arena of Tov and Ra. See, that's what it means. For example, let me give you an illustration. It would be, say, when a person is healthy, he can get anything he wants. He just doesn't even think about it. He doesn't have to think about it at all. What he eats, how much to eat, and so on and so forth. Let's say he has a very good disposition, he's naturally healthy, and his appetites are basically in line, are pretty much in line with his true needs. So he doesn't think about food. All of a sudden he can get a certain type of a disease, and diabetes, whatever it is, a few kinds of problems, right? That's only one, but sometimes a person has a few conditions, and he can't have salt, he can't have sugar, and now just getting through the day and getting the proper nutrition becomes a tremendous drain. He's completely always, every time he picks up an item in the supermarket, he's got to start reading it and thinking about it, and how much can he have, and this and that, and then he has to exercise, and if he ate too much of this, he's completely involved in a whole different thing. Before, he didn't have to think about this. They couldn't relate to it. That's what the Rambam couldn't relate to it. He sees other people, and they have to measure how much they eat, and so on and so forth. He can't understand it. What's going on here? What's the problem? That's what the Rambam means. Not that he didn't understand the meaning of the word good and bad, as we said before. Of course he understood that. But that whole area that we refer to as the apparent truth, the realm of morality, the apparent truth, not absolute truth, because these are all apparent, they're all relative to this particular being, and how he should conduct himself, and so on and so forth, and where to draw the line, ethics, morality, these things had no, he couldn't relate to them. What are you talking about? It doesn't make any sense. He has no concept of what you're talking about, because he's totally involved in the love of, you see, he's totally involved in the love of knowledge. Can't understand what your problem is. What are you talking about? A system of morality. For what? You understand? That's why this story is part of creation. Because man participated in his own creation. He participated in his own creation, and he was responsible for the final outcome, in which he can exist, but only he has a conscience. And bear in mind that we'll continue. We'll see that conscience can be good, conscience can be bad as well. That's the view of Yahweh. The conscience per se is not necessarily good. It becomes a necessity. It becomes a necessity and has to be utilized properly, but in and of itself it's not the cure. It enables man, it just gives him another chance to exist as man and to exercise his bechira. But the perfection of man is what? Is to be a being who's living in accordance with reflection and wisdom, as the Rambam says. That's the purpose of man, and that's what defines him as man. Except now it's a completely different arena, a completely different situation. The Yetzer HaTov, we don't mean one specific thing. The Yetzer HaTov would indicate, means those forces in man that cause him to that go counter to the natural pull of the instincts, would be the Yetzer HaTov. Because the instincts are pulling him in a certain direction, which if he follows them will destroy him. So there are other forces in man which go contrary. The most significant of those are these emotions that we're talking about. However, there's the seichel of man also. So sometimes a person has a desire to do things, and just his seichel, he reads the newspapers, he sees what happens to people that do it, he has a desire, he's attracted to a certain a lifestyle of crime or gambling or whatever it is. And, but then he reads the newspapers, you know, this guy, Gotti, was just put away for life, they got him, and his seichel tells him that it's crazy. That's a Yetzer HaTov. It doesn't, of course, it's not righteousness at this point, he's not doing it for the... he's not doing it for the idealistic reason, but it's a Yetzer HaTov. The fact of the matter is that a person has a certain recognition that if he does certain things, he's going to get into trouble. That Yetzer HaTov would be more from the seichel, as the seichel develops. The kid doesn't have that Yetzer HaTov. The Chazal say you should serve God with the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. So you see that there's nothing which is... It's to you, the ultimate, the service of God is from the... from the seichel. From the telemarket. That's the part of man that serves God. The question of why... That's part and parcel of free will. Of course, in doing this, in creating man with free will, so God gave man the opportunity to destroy himself. But that's always going to be the case. So then we'll ask, well, but if God wants man to live a certain way, so why did he give him the chance to corrupt himself? Well, the answer is that's the definition of free will. So it's not that, so we can no longer, it's not God's will that man should live as a child, per se. That's incorrect. Say that it's God's will that man should be good. Rather, we have to modify this thing. How would you modify the thing? Because that's the question. If it's God's will that man should live a righteous existence, so why didn't he create him in a way, could have created him in a way, that could guarantee that he would live that righteous existence? So therefore, so you can no longer, now you got a problem, because if that's God's will, so and we see it's not happening, so you led to the possibility that there's a defect in God that he can't achieve his will. So then, but then you have to, that's not God's will. So what do you mean, it's not God's will that man should live a righteous existence? And the answer is that, what's the proper formula? What is God's will? That man should live this righteous existence as a result of his own choice. That man should be the cause of his own goodness. That's the will of God. And that's the whole idea of the fear of God. That's the will of God. So it's not the will of God to say that that man should simply be good. That's why people just, you know, this is like a science fiction speculation type of thing. Let's say we could discover the goodness code. Let's say we could discover a goodness code, which would make everybody in the world excited. By taking it, let's assume, I mean, you know, it sounds crazy, but today's science, I'm sure there are people. Although today they're more concerned with the evil film. They're trying to kill, you know, the scientists are more geared towards power. They want the pill that will give them superhuman power, not for righteousness. But let's say we could find a citrus pill. And this pill would be administered in the proper dose, and everybody would be their most perfect self and come and learn and do mitzvot and chesed and so forth. What would you do? As the one in charge of the project, I would, in the middle of the night, you see, we can diffuse it through the air. We would have the airplanes flying over in a fine dust, and everybody would breathe it in and would wake up in a state of sickness and friendship and love and happiness and doing mitzvot and jumping for joy at any good thing. And sitting and learning endlessly until such time as there was a need to get up and do a mitzvah and help somebody. What would you do? Bit of a dilemma. If you withhold it from mankind, and then World War III breaks out with all its consequences, and you know that had you administered the pill, you know, Mashiach would have been there. What would you do as an ethicist? It seems to be a resounding no, because it's connected to the song of God. Because what you're saying is like this then. What about the question is, but there's a great good here. Yeah. So what about all the souls? There's a great good. There will be, no doubt about it. Millions and millions of souls will be destroyed. We can predict it. We see it happening all the time. We have the capacity to save them. That's the dilemma. There's no doubt that they're going to be destroyed. If you take a look at the world today, and you see the millions, I don't know if you know the planet, but the overwhelming millions are going to be destroyed in terms of what we consider to be perfection. False philosophies, false ideas, billions. And that's just destruction. And Masa Yodei tells them beyond the Atamon and Shiri. You can't just fly by saying, you know, you can't sing Shiri when people are going down. God's, the work of God's hand. And we can say that. So they're not using their Bechir anyway. Or if they are using it, they're using it for the Iraq.
Which is for the bad.
So can we do it or not? The answer still has to be we can't do it. Why? For what? In other words, we can't define a good on our own. It, from our own perspective, this seems to be a good. And given, it is true that it would be better. In our understanding, but certainly since it's God's will, that man should not just be good, but be the cause of his goodness, then certainly that would be the best. But what we're saying is that it's not working. Because man is not choosing to be the cause of his own goodness. Man is choosing to be the cause of his own bad. Given that that is the case, given that one can predict that millions of people in a certain society are going to be lost, destroyed, would it not be better that they get dispelled? Now, from our standpoint, we'd say yes. But the point is, we can't operate from our standpoint. We can only operate from the standpoint. We can't isolate anything and call it the good, because that's the way it appears to us. The only thing that we... Whatever we call good is good, not because it looks good to us. It's only because God has defined it as good. Isn't that, that's the same thing? That's different. It's in line. It's in line. Yeah. We don't have... That's the problem that people... The problem that people have, the reason why they introduce changes into Torah and they deviate, is because they all have an idea of how to improve things. Wouldn't it be much better today in order to reach people if we made certain modifications and we'd achieve such and such results and bring people closer? Right? Because in your mind, that would be good. Yes, that may be true. That's the way it appears to you. But we're operating with the concept that we really do not have any innate idea of what is good. What is good is what God has commanded us. The command of God defines it as good. So therefore, by definition, this can't be good. What's good is that we operate in line with God's will. And it's not God's will that man should have such will. Man must have free will, and man must have the situation. Now, what we spoke about before, about using the power of persuasion, to get people to do the good, that is something else. Because that is not the removal of his free will. And you're helping him to exercise his free will in the most propitious way. But in the final analysis, he will choose the path of goodness as a result of the exercise of his free will. That is fine. But we spoke about bypassing the free will. Instantaneous, automatic, instinctual goodness. That cannot be. Because though it appears to us as a good, God has not defined it as a good. This, there'd be now all these movements to change Yahadus, to make it modern, to make it better, to improve upon it. It's based upon a desire that these people have a concept of the good. And they want to help God fulfill. They want to help God do what the answer is, that's not for you to decide. You have no idea, you cannot define something as good. What good is what God has told us. And we have to be there to be in line with the will of God. And that's it. There's no other way. That is part and parcel of his free will. In other words, that you make choices and that your life will be determined by the choices that you make. And what you're doing is you're bypassing that. You're going counter to that. In other words, God doesn't interfere with man's free will. We see that God does not interfere with man's free will. Like if you decide to shoot someone, right? So God doesn't interfere and push the gun out of your hand, right? You have the God allows you to exercise, even though the other person is going to be killed. That's part and parcel of Hershus Masuna. Which means to say that that's the way the world has to function, and no matter what the crime, that's good, in a sense. And in other words, that Harishus Masuna means that that's the way reality was constructed and designed. that man operates in accordance with his free will. Of course, you'll say, if that's the case, what would you jump in to stop the guy from shooting somebody else? I know that's the next question. The answer is yes, because you have an obligation. You have an obligation here, which is God has given you to save somebody else's life. You would even, but you'd say, even if you can go further, let's say a person is about to do an avera, which doesn't hurt somebody else. A little avodah zarah, would you jump on him and lock him up? And the point is, if a person, the direction that a person chooses to go, because that's the way the world has been constructed. Because that's part and parcel of the phenomenon of free will. And that is that you don't stop a person. You do stop a person in a manner which will improve him. And improvement will be through helping him to see the stupidity of his ways. You don't help a person by locking him up. You can take a person and you can incarcerate him and lock him up and he'll never sin. That's not helping him in any way. Okay? That's removing the reality of her shustness. The idea of din and rachman is not that God has two different attributes. But sometimes, because God only operates perfectly. Right? So you can't say that sometimes God acts with justice and sometimes God acts in a different way. A man could be that way. A human could be that way. So God is perfect. It means to say there's two manifestations. Din over here means when God is operating in accordance with the ideal. The absolute idea. That's why the creation, when God created the world, it was created, everything was in accordance with the blueprint of the absolute ideal. The second account means, Rachman, that adjustments are made, that God allows for certain adjustments when man deviates from the ideal and enables him to exist, you see, in spite of his deviation. That is what we refer to as Rachman. And that's where the punishments come in, you see? The punishments are the Rachman. That they're the adjustment. Because this is not the ideal that man should have conscience. The ideal is that man should have the Yetzer of Chutz, and he should just have the reason. And tell him all him and instinct. That's the ideal. And the new man that emerges as a result of the faith, right, who experiences shame, that new man is not the ideal. But nevertheless, the will of God relates to that being as well. See, that's the adjustment. So we call it Rachman. From our standpoint, it's Rachman. But in God, it's not Rachman. In the way we understand it, it doesn't mean that God has a component of mercy. If there's one word which indicates that what is happening over here is more than just the normal result of disobedience, but a transformation, there's one word. There's one phrase that indicates that. That tells you to stop. I mean, I'm also concerned here about methodology in Chumash. How to go from the psukim to the ideas. Well, what would you say? That's a psalm. I mean, in any time you're learning Chumash, you have to pause and analyze. What do you mean their eyes were open? Of course their eyes were open. But that indicates a change. Something changed. Their eyes were open to something to which it had not been opened before. And as the Rambam explains, the Rambam goes into that. It doesn't mean that until now their eyes were closed and they hadn't seen that they were naked and that now suddenly they saw that which they hadn't seen before. It meant that the idea of nakedness suddenly came into being. So that tells you that there is something going on over here. Now, as we explained it, based on the Rambam, it meant that there was a fundamental change in the nature of Adam, in terms of the direction of the psychic energy. That pre the chait, the way his psyche was established was that he did have Yetzer Hara, he did have the inclination,
Now, the evil inclination, as we've explained, doesn't mean that it's evil. It just means that he's attracted to the instinctual, that which is not really in his best interest, but which is a necessity. There's nothing evil about that. However, it has the capacity, due to the factor of the human imagination and fantasy, to set itself up in the mind of the individual as a good. That's when it becomes evil. There's nothing inherently wrong with the instinctual. It's necessary for man. That's the way he's designed. But man has the capacity to take something which is a necessity and transform it through the process of imagination and idealization into a good. When he does that, then it becomes evil for man, because now he's pursuing something which is not the good as the good. That's what's evil for man. That's why it's called the Yetzer Hara, because of that tendency. Okay? Now, the Yetzer Hara was a kut, means that by his nature he didn't fantasize, he didn't hunger after the instinctual. By nature, his desire was towards what? And then the Torah has described this for us in just a few sukkim, which indicate what he did on the first day, the first 2 hours, the first hour. We see it clearly because what he was engaged in was the naming of the animals. What he was engaged in was the naming of the animals, and along with that, it says, "Well, the Adam Lamasa Ezer Kenegdo," that he hadn't found an Ezer, a helper. He hadn't found his proper mate. So he was a creature who was designed to be involved in intellectual activity, in studying the creation, and via the study of the creation, to have a relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was the purpose, and that was what he was engaged in by nature, so to speak. His nature drew him in that direction. But at the same time, he did have within him the need for an instinctual outlet, but that was the good. That wasn't his primary drive. And he had the choice to remain in that state or to transform himself. And that would bring him into the realm of Tov Hara. That's why the tree, let's focus on that. What I'm doing here is sort of by way of review, in other words. Sort of a review of the ideas that we've been developing the last couple of weeks, and through these questions, you know, just to see that everybody has it straight. Let me ask you this question on the Bechina then. What does it mean? See, all these terms, everything in this whole parsha is extremely important. The terms, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, something you wouldn't have any concept of what he's talking about. But now, as a result of the Rambam's explanation, we can understand it. So what does it mean, the tree? But this is the tree that he was commanded not to eat from, because if he did eat from this tree, then he would be transforming himself into a different type of a being. So that tree is characterized by the knowledge of good and evil. Why so? Say he was not involved in, because good and evil is the realm of what the Rambam calls apparent truth, not absolute truth, but within the relative to the way the individual creature is supposed to live his life. It's not that Adam didn't understand the meaning of the word good and evil. He had to, because otherwise he could not receive a command. So he knew that it was good to follow the will of God. He knew that it was bad to disobey. He knew all that. But it meant that he wasn't preoccupied with setting boundary lines for himself. The world of morality, ethics and morality is completely involved in drawing boundary lines about what's mine, what's yours, or what is permitted and what's prohibited, and how much and when and where. And we're totally preoccupied with all these questions of good and bad. Good and bad is subjective knowledge. It's not objective. He was designed to be totally involved in the world of objective, necessary truth, which means absolute truth, truth pertaining to reality itself, the world of nature, science and the like, absolute truth, but not to be fixated on personal, the apparent truth. That, however, came into being because of the transformation. As a result of the chet, he changed the structure. You see, the entire direction of his energy was now geared towards the physical, which is the way we are right now. In other words, we don't know. We've never experienced the state of Adam Harishon. We experienced the opposite. In other words, a person by nature is disposed towards the instinctual, what we call the taivas, the desires.
right? And that's where, you know, that's where your natural inclination draws you. You want to have fun, you want to play games, you want to eat, you know, you want to go to the movies, you know, but you don't want to go and learn. It's not something you naturally run to, you know, like the expression of the Katinok, like a child that runs...
Habareth.
Like a child that runs away from school. That's the expression Chazal used. That's the natural thing, because school's not, you can't wait to get out of there. Now, as a person progresses, so he can hopefully develop, he has to cultivate a love of knowledge, and everybody's capable of doing so, or ever does so. But as a person, if he has the proper training and disposition, so then he can cultivate a love of knowledge, and that you know, the energy will be more and more directed towards knowledge. But essentially, the way we're constructed is that our energy is drawn towards the physical. Now, as a result of this, as a result of the faith, his nature was changed, and really he was supposed to be destroyed. That's what it means when it says, and on the day that you eat from it, you will die. Meaning you will not have, because you exist only because of the will of God. And since you exist only because of the will of God will relate to you only as long as you fulfill your purpose. And that is to be a human being who lives in accordance with reflection. As the Rambam says, now he wouldn't live in accordance with reflection. Just the opposite, he'd be the most dangerous being, because he'd be a being who would be driven by his instincts. But the mind would now be a tool of that's why man is the most dangerous animal. We see that in our own. We see that in our own time. All the destruction a person like Hitler, Yamach Shemo, is because here's an individual who's dominated completely by his instincts, and he has a good mind. And when you have that combination, a good mind in the service of the instincts, then this is the most destructive being. That's not Adam. That being shouldn't exist. It wasn't God's will that a being should exist with instincts and that combination of instincts and intellect, without something to direct that utilization of the intellect towards the good, is the most dangerous thing on earth. And that's what we have in the world today. That's why the world is dominated by these tyrants. And it's the intelligent ones are the dangerous ones. So Churchill referred to him as the evil genius. Can't write him off as a fool. If he was a fool, he wouldn't have accomplished. No, fools don't accomplish anything. But that combination of genius with evil, that was a very good insight. Like, this being shouldn't exist. So this being should be killed. So, but he's not. So what happens? He's saved. How is he saved? Something comes along. God's part of God. There is an element in God's plan that enables him to survive the experience. And what is that? Kipakatna ene shneihem vayedu kierumim. What saves him is a new faculty comes into being, which he didn't have before. Shame. Conscience. See? That's why this, as we've explained, that's why this story is part of the creation. Because the creation of man was incomplete. Man was, as we say, was involved in his own creation. He was given the choice. He was given the choice to determine what type of an existence he would have. Now, having sinned and transformed his nature, he was really not worthy of existence, because now he would be totally under the control of his instincts. However, God created another faculty which would act as a counterbalance to the instincts. See? And that counterbalance is what we call the conscience. So now, he can still exist, because the danger was that there'd be nothing to control. The mind, in and of itself, would not be enough to control the instincts. It would be enslaved by the instincts. But now, God has created a new faculty. This is very important, because we have to understand the role of conscience. Conscience, again, does not determine what's good and bad. This is a fundamental yesod over here. Most people make the mistake of believing that it is conscience. The conscience in man is the element which determines what's good and what's bad, and one should follow one's conscience. This is not true according to the others. The purpose of conscience is to enable man to exercise his faculty of reason, and only through reason can he discover the good. The only thing is that without an emotional factor to offset the force of instinct, man would not be free to utilize his reason. Because the reason would be completely controlled by the instinctual as a result of the chait.
So that's why God created a conscience. That's why this story is the God is described here as being Hashem Elokim, the Midas as we said, the Midas Harachamim. Because in terms of Midas Aden, which means relating to man in terms of the ideal, that's the first story. That's the first account where that's pre-Bechet. That's where man is purely man does not have a conscience. Man qua man does not have conscience. It's not part of his essence, so to speak. And as a result of his chait and God adjusting to the changes that are necessitated by man's deviation, that's Hashem Elokim, then he receives this faculty. Well, I call it the superego. It means that man, the reason why a person feels shame is because he has a faculty within him, which means like the ego ideal, his ego ideal. And that's in opposition to the instinctual, because we'll soon see more expressions of this. A lot of things come into being now because of this. See, due to the fact that he has an ego ideal, so he can no longer live as a behemoth. That's why he feels shame whenever he feels. See, it's not just in the sexual. The primary expression was in the sexual. That the way the superego is structured, it is an immediate opposition to the sexual. That's why the first expression is shame. The first expression is shame as a result of the fact that they were naked. It also produces feelings of guilt, depression, and so forth, because the person feels that he's not lived up to his ego ideal. Whenever a person feels that he has not lived up to his ego ideal, so he feels either guilty or shame, there's variations here. That's the faculty. It seems to me the Torah basically describes the effects of this. Chazal referred to it as the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination. But it's an inclination, that's the perfect description, it's an inclination. It just inclines in a certain direction. You see how it can become corrupted. The superego can become corrupted. If you're a superego, that's why you see in halacha. That you're not allowed to learn Torah from a Rebbe who's not perfected in his deeds, in his mind, no matter how smart he is. Why? Because he becomes, Torah is more than just abstract knowledge. It means to internalize it, to live in accordance with the values. So the Torah recognizes that until a person reaches a certain level, the main factor that's influencing him is the identification with the Rebbe, with the personality of the Rebbe. So if that personality is corrupt, it's going to carry over. So that's why it's just an inclination. And the more people did evil because of a corrupted superego than any other factor. That's what's responsible for most of the evil in the world, is the corruption of the superego. That's the whole story of Germany. When the collective conscience of a nation can be in line with an ideology which is totally false, so then man is destroyed. Because that's the only thing that's left. You've broken down the last dam. You know, the floodgates are now open. The only thing that was that can control man, who would otherwise be an instinctual being, is this new faculty, the superego. So that has now become aligned with evil, so then man is going to be totally evil and he's going to feel good about it. Because that feeling of goodness is because you're following your conscience. You feel you did the right thing. That was the experience of many of the Nazis who weren't repentant. Tshuva will, by and large, where man is now constructed, the conscience is very important in Tshuva, because after a person sins, that's when the conscience kicks in. And as a result of that, you see, but simply emotional regret is not Tshuva, obviously. People go through cycles of sin, emotional regret, and then when that wears off, they go back to sin. That's the emotional regret can be the trigger which kicks off a process in which the person undergoes a transformation and recognizes the mistake that he has made and takes the steps to change his nature so that he won't do it again. That's why the Rambam says, Kabbalah ala asin, is the, without that, you don't have tshuva. In other words, the person merely is regretful and he apologizes to God, so to speak, and whatever, feels shame, but cannot
separate himself from the chay. So that's not true, according to Rambam. It's got to be.